A long car trip, a small pile of sawdust, and a very creative use of a crayon. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I am Krissa Hewitt, and Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice-monthly program which my co-host Stephen DeLuque and I produce here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Normally, our program focuses on explorations of the visual arts, but this is December, and for 15 prior years, this being number 16, we have used this time to have community members tell stories based on a given theme. This year's theme is The Gift is Immaterial. A lot of different ways that one could look at that, and you will see from the stories you hear today that that is exactly what has happened. When Stephen and I came up with it, our thought is that sometimes a physical gift, sometimes maybe just an emotional one, can have an impact for years to come, maybe even for a lifetime. Today you will hear 7 stories, and we will continue next week with some more. We actually have probably a couple of spaces, so if you're interested in sharing a true personal story, please send me an email at chewitt, H-E-W-I-T-T, at calpoly.edu. You'll have to get them in the next couple of days. We start off today with a story about a birthday cake.
Hello, I'm Jan Alarcon, a licensed clinical psychologist. This birthday cake, not my car accident, is the best gift I had ever received. A week after my car accident, I entered an extended care facility. All but one of us was there to heal our broken bones, rest, and wait for your x-rays to change. A furry snowball will surround the break, then disappear. A solid white line will replace it. Be of good cheer. A bone never breaks in the same place twice. I wait for 2 months for my 27 lines to appear. Teresa has no broken bones. Teresa, on compassionate care, has an inoperable brain tumor. She's 31. Commensurate with her status, Teresa has a sunny corner room with glass walls and views of both gardens. A trolley car, replenished daily with home-baked goods, resides at her door. Her children visit every morning, her church every evening. All link arms and pray around her. Teresa's eyes will open and express concern, forgiveness, prophecy. The interpretation is up to you. Her husband visits nightly at the end of his shift, never before 10 p.m. That gives me time to sneak into her room unnoticed and shave the stubble off her chin. I'm tired of the float staff calling her sir. Her husband wails loudest on his drunkest days. His pleas to God rock me to sleep, startle me awake, and invade my dreams. All the broken ones leave before my second month. A compassionate care sign swings above the nursing station, squeaking throughout the night. The halls contain distraught loved ones with wish-you-well cookies. I can't avoid wheeling over chocolate chips. Their medical charts are blue, do not resuscitate. Mine is gray. Resuscitate if you can, she just might heal. Nobody dies until my birthday. An orderly gives me my first happy birthday while emptying my bedpan. I spend the daylight hours wheeling myself around the hospital grounds, blocking out thoughts of my chair and uncertain future. I return for supper to a ward in commotion. Teresa is lying in the middle of the day room. Her room has been temporarily assigned to Marguerite so that Marguerite's family can celebrate her 96th birthday with balloons, banners, and a mariachi band. The nurses ignore Teresa's irate husband and giggle while wheeling me towards a table. A pink sheet cake in its center wishes the best to Marguerite and me. All sing, Happy birthday, dear Jan and Marga. Loudspeakers interrupt. Code blue, code red, any doctor? Staff and machines rush into the corner room. Family and balloons rush out. Mama's dead, a daughter tells me as she ties balloons on my handles. Died on her 96. Bet you'll do the same. Enough cheeriness and death. I leave the table and join Teresa. Come back. An otherwise hygienic nurse wipes Marguerite's name off the frosting with her blue-gloved hand. This cake is for you. 5 birthdays later, I think about the car accident only when climbing upstairs. I no longer worry about Teresa and her hairy chin, but I'm still plagued by the image of Marguerite in her body bag. Every October 9th, I buy a pink sheet cake with Marguerite written on it. I wipe her name off with my bare hand, count how many years I have left before 96, while swirling the letters around my fingertips and dropping them to the ground.
I'm Robin Smith, and I've lived on the Central Coast for almost 20 years. I recently started a website that enables shoppers to buy from local artists online. It's called Art Shop Central Coast. My projects, including this recent one, have a high degree of risk. One reason I'm comfortable launching risky endeavors is because of my great aunt Nana giving me the inspiration to go for it in life. This is her story. I never knew my grandmother, Flora. She died when I was a baby. Her sister took on the role of grandmother, and I called her Nana. She was born in 1887 in rural Canada. At that time, any kind of travel was difficult. The family rode a buckboard to town, and it was an all-day, dusty, dirty affair. Later, her family lost their farm and immigrated to Nebraska, and for a while lived in a poorhouse. In the 30s, she married her husband Chet, a fireman in Los Angeles. They were blessed with a steady income during the Depression, but they took in boarders to help. Nana was simply astounded by what she had witnessed in life. The Roaring Twenties, the Great Depression, the First World War, and then World War II. Luckily, their son lived through his Navy service in the Pacific. She was thoroughly sick of war after Korea and Vietnam. She was mesmerized by every hour of the televised Watergate hearings. As a youngster, she traveled by horse and buggy. As a grown woman, she flew by jet to the Orient. She watched a live television broadcast of men walking on the moon. "Isn't life amazing?" she would say. "There's just no stopping us." However, by far, the most prized development in her life was the automobile and freeways. Today, we complain about traffic and absolutely dread driving over that mysterious dividing line, the grade. My Nana loved driving. She and Chet would drive 5 hours or more just for lunch. They loved to drive long distances and camp. No big RV, just their little car, a tent, and meal trappings. Nana taught me to love life and to be fearless. At the age of 83, she did something amazing. She decided to drive to Canada from her home in the San Fernando Valley, alone. Chet had died several decades earlier. With the help of her son, she planned out a travel itinerary that featured 4 to 5 hours of driving per day. Our family thought she was nuts. It was too risky for an old woman to drive that distance alone. Her son tried to talk her out of it, but she was determined. The only concession she made was to call home every night when she checked into her motel. It took several weeks, but she made it. I think she had guts. Whenever I'm scared, whenever I fear failing, I think of my Nana on that trip. When I'm 83, God willing, I'm going to drive to Canada just like my Nana.
My name is Diane Gross-Giese. I moved to San Luis Obispo County 27 years ago, and I live and work in Templeton, California. The following is a poem I wrote for my friend David Lee. He died of colon cancer metastasis this July. I dedicate this reading to his wife, Lori, his children, Alex and Joe, his American Cancer Society Walk for Life team, the Star Trekkers, and hospice. David Lee was a lover of science fiction, and you will hear references in the poem. Like wind on the water, you make a great wake. People say the spirit is like the wind. We cannot see it, but we see its effects, feel its presence, like wind on the water. You, David, make a great wake. Your voice is unique. In smooth, calm, lilting tenor tones, it sailed over the intercom at Sierra Vista Medical Center. Lori Ridge, please return to the nurse's station. As the ocean sends us its spray and hush, your voice comes to us like wind on the water. Without even touching, people rock each other. There's a dark matter connecting us, immeasurable and unseen. It's a disturbance in the force, so to speak. Like a bobbing rubber ducky in the bath, or a cannonball wave shoving us aside when you jump in the pool. We undulate and shudder in your wake. Now take sunlight, how it transforms, becoming a matrix in moving water. It's almost tactile below the surface, but evanescent. Flashing webs of flickering lines etch across the pool bottom and dance to forces stirring within the pool. Like wind on the water, we can see your great wake. A human being is such a bag of mostly water. When you arrived on this planet, you broke your mother's water and perhaps she cried. Tears flow into trickles, streams flow into rivers, to the sea, and return as rain. This is the bond of water. A man's water belongs to the tribe. In two new people, your water runs through their veins, making new wakes, defining their own courses. Forget about ashes to ashes. It's water to water. For even in a time of great drought, you shared what you had, like a stranger in a strange land, you grok. You deeply understand how we thirst for connection. The ultimate Boy Scout, you always came prepared to share. You make a great wake in the waters of life. So to paraphrase James T. Kirk, Starfleet captain on the Enterprise, you could feel the wind at your back, about you, the sounds of the sea beneath you. And even if you take away the wind and the water, it's still the same. The vessel is yours. You can feel it. And the stars are still there. And we still feel your wake.
You're listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio. We continue now with our December storytelling program. The theme, The Gift is Immaterial.
I'm Carol McKibben, a retired Cal Poly professor who was turned to an avocation of writing in my retirement. This is a true story called A Christmas Ball. The essential equipment for a third grader with big league aspirations are a glove, a bat, and a baseball. I possessed a glove of the home run Baker era I discovered in my dad's dusty footlocker. Mom's rolling pin could serve as a bat, but I didn't have a ball. "Mommy, do you think Santa Claus might bring me a baseball for Christmas?" I asked. My mother swiveled toward me in her sewing machine chair and pulled me close. "Sweetie, leather is needed for the war effort. It's pretty doubtful Santa will have a ball for you." I had a hard time connecting leather and war. "Does our army throw baseballs at the Nazis?" I asked. "No," she chuckled. "The leather is for boots for our troops." Now I understood. Indeed, I felt guilty thinking a new baseball might make a soldier go barefoot. I revised my wish list. When Christmas Eve arrived, we enjoyed our usual oyster stew for supper before I hung my stocking on the fireplace mantel. On the kitchen table, I left a glass of milk, a chocolate chip cookie, and a note for Santa Claus. "Dear Santa, I hope you like the cookie and milk. Thanks for whatever you leave me. I'm hoping you might have a used baseball in your sack. I've been good this year." Mom set my alarm clock to ring at 7 on Christmas morning. If you go downstairs to see what Santa left before your alarm goes off, she warned, everything in your stocking will turn to dust. I awoke long before 7 and endured the clock slowly ticking away the time. When the alarm finally sounded, I jumped out of bed, bounced down the stairs, and raced to my Christmas stocking. Something round bulged in the middle of the red sock. I yanked out shelled peanuts and hard ribbon candy, eager to get to the mysterious sphere. Alas, I discovered an orange. My eyes watered. I turned my head downward. "Maybe you were looking for this," Mom said, and handing me something round and wrapped in red tissue. I tore off the flimsy wrapping and discovered a ball with a yellow canvas cover. "It's a baseball," Mom shouted with glee. My mother beamed with happiness, and oh, how I wanted to share her joy. But this strange object would never pass as the real thing. Billy Ryotsky, a neighbor friend, owned a true baseball that was larger, heavier, and with stitching you could feel. The supposed stitching on my ball was printed, along with the notation, "Particle wood interior, do not hit." "Don't you like it?" Mom asked. "Yeah, this is really nice." Mom sensed my disappointment. "You know, they don't play baseball at the North Pole. Santa Claus probably doesn't know a lot about the game. Besides, there's a war on. He just did the best he could." I tried to smile while puzzling over the do not hit warning on the phony baseball. Wasn't that the object of the game? The next day, I teed up the ball on our front porch railing and took a vicious swipe with my rolling pin bat. Whack! Sawdust flew. The erstwhile ball fell limply to the ground. I now owned a yellow bean bag. P.S. By the next Christmas, World War II had ended, and Santa delivered a brand new baseball.
Hello, I'm Cheryl Heber, a longtime resident of Slo County, a genealogist, a maker of Christmas stockings, and a writer of short stories, screenplays, and novels. This story is titled Practical Gifts. I schlepped the weight of people's lives, debt, love found and shot to hell, and sappy wish-you-were-here vacation lies. I deliver the mail. My earbuds pulsate hard rock that keeps the tedium of tract housing from making mush of my brain. December freeze, ice cubes for toes. So irksome this holiday cheer, and the tonnage of advertising is backbreaking. Midway through my suburban drudge across the low walking bridge over Fletcher Creek. For days now, I've seen a scruffy girl. She might be 8, peeking out from the graffiti. She watches me. I flinch some when I talk to folks, so just get the job done, then home and off my swollen feet. But I stop and meet her gaze. She has a vacant look, too dark for such a tyke, like the orphans in combat rubble. I wave at her. She hightails it. "Yesterday," I said, "happy holidays." A thoughtless remark in hindsight, as clearly there's no joy for this kid. Today, she glares back, shivering, no jacket, bare legs, ratty shoes. "What's your name?" I ask. She answers by reaching up to me, a letter in her hand. I lean over the bridge rail and take it. She turns and runs. Addressed to Santa, it's scrawled on a greasy brown bag in blue crayon. After work, I marinate on my couch in PTSD detention, Aerosmith blocking an invasion of bloody screams and concussive explosions. I reread that brown bag letter. There are no toys on this wish list. Tuna fish, toothpaste, tarps, and please, a job for my dad. Next day, I wait on Fletcher Bridge. She doesn't show, so I shimmy down the 6-foot decline and head toward her last seen path. Dried thistle weeds pull at my jeans. I find what must be their home. 2 sleeping bags under a shelter of cracked corrugated plastic. I recognize her T-shirt hung on a stick. Christmas Eve. I don't do gifts, but I steel myself to tackle the torment of big box shopping. Pulling stuff off of shelves for somebody other than me knocks bricks loose from my misery mortar. Christmas morning. It's drizzling, an oh dark 30, but I want there to be a surprise when the sun comes up. I haul black plastic trash bags stuffed with booty and keep my flashlight pointed down. The rain makes a racket on their corrugated palace. Underneath, 2 bodies sleep. I step on a twig and a man sits up quick. He aims a weapon and for an instant I'm back at the desert bloodbath, stifling a shriek. But it's only a steak knife duct taped to a PVC pipe. I let the bags fall, raising my hand so he can see my face with my flashlight. "I'm a friend," I whisper. "I brought you something." I've shoved the bags with my foot. He grabs his own flashlight. Rifling through, he looks at me, confused, then lowers his shanty saber. "I didn't wrap them," I say, dropping my arms. His daughter's still asleep. "These are all on her list, but I added a few things." He pulls out a doll, a pink jacket, a tin of cookies. "That envelope's for you," I tell him. "A job application for the Postal Service. No guarantees, but worth a try." He looks stunned. "Thank you," he says with a reverence I don't deserve. I turn to leave, then reconsider. "My pleasure," I tell him, but it doesn't convey my overdue good riddance to a decade of pity parties. Back home, I yank out my earbuds. Suddenly, Motley Crue is a blitzkrieg. I help neighbor Loopy with her turkey and offer the condo super a beer. Most perplexing, I look up the address of my estranged sister. My battle demons have her sort of spooked. Then I pull out some paper and write my new bridge fans a thank you letter. I'll deliver it tomorrow. They're on my route.
Hello, my name is Ruth Barrera Cown. I enjoy writing stories about my experiences growing up as a Mexican American during the early 50s and 60s. This piece is entitled Mi Rosita. I stared at the muñeca and felt my heart sink. Why did Santa bring me this ugly doll? I thought I had made it perfectly clear in my letter. Dear Santa, I want a doll with dark brown braids, brown eyes, and brown skin. And to be sure he understood, I wrote my letter in Spanish. This doll had blonde hair, blue eyes, and pale skin. Every girl in my first grade class wanted Santa to bring them a Susie Walker doll, but not me. Why didn't Santa's elves make my doll with dark brown braids, brown eyes, and skin the color of rich soil? And I thought Mrs. Claus would tat a lacy mantilla for her head and a rebozo to wear around her shoulders. But instead, Santa left this foreign-looking doll. What would I name her? She didn't even look like a Rosita. I would have to speak to her in my broken English because I could tell she didn't understand Spanish. I didn't put this Susie Walker on my bed, but let her lay on the floor, where my dog Rusty would occasionally sniff her. Then I had a brilliant idea. I got a box of Crayolas and pulled out the brown-colored crayon. I then colored every inch of her pale skin a beautiful brown. I grabbed a tin of shoe polish and used a face towel to rub the polish into her blonde hair. The strong, gas-like odor got my brother's attention. When he saw my newly christened Rosita, his eyes grew large, his jaw dropped, and he said, "I'm telling on you." I looked at mi Rosita and wondered, why am I in trouble? Oh, maybe I shouldn't have used the face towel. Mom came into the room, and her eyes widened and her jaw dropped. "Ay, mijita, ¿qué has hecho?" What have you done? She covered her face with her apron. I heard muffled sounds that made me think Mama was crying. I saw her shoulders heave up and down. I looked at mi Rosita and had to admit that she looked somewhat deranged, but that would change when I figured out how to make her blue eyes brown. Other than that, I thought she was beautiful. Mi Mama wasn't crying. She was laughing. She hugged me and said, "Mijita, qué bonita es tu muñeca." She thought my doll was beautiful. Mama let me keep my brown crayon-colored Rosita, but I had to wash off the shoe polish. Mama braided black yarn over the blonde hair, gave me a mantilla, and crocheted a bright red rebozo. I loved mi Rosita. But the best gift that Christmas wasn't Rosita. The gift I remember most was realizing that brown is beautiful.
Hi, I'm Jeannie Murdoch. I'm a writer and satirist who lives in Paso Robles, California. You might know me by my brand of books. The brand is called Bean Fit. I'm going to read a story to you. The story is called Harmonica. When my family used to exchange presents, there was always a theme to my gifts. In 2005, it was music. For my niece, I prepared a gift bag with a harmonica and harmonica instruction book. For my nephew, I prepared a bag with a CD and a piano instruction book. They already owned a keyboard. Phew! I wouldn't have been able to have fit a keyboard in the bag. I spent Christmas Eve with my sister and her kids. Christmas morning, while the kids were still sleeping, I told my sister that I was going to visit a friend and that I would return in plenty of time to watch the kids open their presents. When I arrived on time, I found that the kids were already awake and had already rifled through all of their presents, even the ones that I gave them. I was so mad that my sister didn't make them wait for me to return. Since I was lazy and thought that I would be there when the kids opened the gifts from me, I didn't put their names on the bags. As a result, they opened the wrong gifts. My niece received the keyboard instruction book and CD, and my nephew received the harmonica and instruction book. My niece didn't take to playing instruments, whereas my nephew immediately started playing the harmonica and didn't put it down all night. 10 years later, he is a professional blues harmonica player. He plays with internationally acclaimed musicians and is very well known and respected in the San Jose blues scene. He's only 26 years old. It is magical to help a child discover his passion, something that I hope I have done more of and will continue to do. Since I have a long list of passions, I can think of several times when someone placed a passion in my hands. For example, when I was 9 years old, my mom gave me a Vivitar camera for Christmas. It didn't take long before I was hooked on photography. Throughout childhood, most of my photos were of my friends and family. In college, I discovered landscape photography. After college, I started traveling extensively, at which time, and ever since then, my photos became a representational documentary of my travels. That gift turned into a profession in 2008 when I sold my first photo. Since then, people have hired me for photo shoots. I think it's interesting how my parents consciously molded me to be an elementary school teacher or otherwise a homemaker, while unknowingly presenting me with the tools for future passions and professions.
And yes, that was Jeannie's nephew on the harmonica. You have been listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX. Want to thank members of the community who told their stories today. Jan Alarcon, Robin Smith, Diane Gross-Giese, Carol McKibben, Cheryl Heber, Ruth Berea-Cown, and Jeannie Murdoch. Next week will be part two of this annual December Storytelling Fest. Again, our theme this year has been The Gift is Immaterial. This is Chrissy Hewitt. And on behalf of my co-host, Stephen DeLuque, I want to wish you a happy Hanukkah, a Merry Christmas, and just the best of good cheer. Thanks so much for listening.